Welcome back to the Crit Medic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallenzak. Things have been pretty busy here over the past couple of weeks. Our Narcan podcast was an unexpected smash hit. It seems that EMS providers are passionate about their Narcan, if nothing else. I've had a crazy busy schedule the past couple of weeks. Between two agencies, I was scheduled for 94 hours of work. I had to scale it back a bit due to threats of bodily harm from the crit wife. I've put together ventilator training and PowerPoint to help the folks at my primary service learn Ventilator Management 101. I'll probably share it here as a future podcast. This week, I wanted to change things up a little bit and discuss a critical care scenario. I think it raises several good points and presents a potentially challenging management quandary. If you're able to visit the Crit Medic website for this podcast, the presentation and details are written down there as well. So if you'd like to, go ahead and head over there now and check out the lab values and presentation before we talk about them here on the podcast. So, without further ado, here's the scenario. You respond to Podunk Community Hospital, a rural freestanding ED/hair salon, to transfer a patient to the MICU at a tertiary care facility 1 hour away for a higher level of care. The patient is a 44-year-old female with a history of insulin-dependent diabetes and a current diagnosis of DKA. Laboratory blood glucose is 940 milligrams per deciliter, which is 68.6 grains per pint for you imperial or apothecary folks. Patient's GCS is 224 for a total of 8, and she's breathing 30 to 40 times per minute and saturating 88% on a non-rebreather. She's got an 18-gauge IV in her right AC and received 1,000 milliliters of saline. The patient is being transferred with an insulin drip running at 12 units per hour. She has vomited times 4 since being admitted to the ED. Let's stop right there for a moment. Right off the bat, we have some cause for concern. This patient is in DKA. As noted, the respiratory rate is pretty high, 30 to 40. Does anyone remember back in EMT Basic? You were luckily taught that if the patient is breathing too fast or too slow, you could bag the patient to help them with their breathing and correct their rate. Because too fast isn't good either, right? Does anyone want to do that here? If you're saying no because you sense a loaded question, you are correct. Bagging this patient to slow down their rate will kill this patient. You may as well cut out the middleman and just put a pillow over their face. They are breathing that fast as a compensatory mechanism for metabolic acidosis, so we absolutely don't want to discourage this rate. However, the problem I'm seeing here is that she has a low GCS of around 8 and has already vomited 4 times. Can she effectively protect her airway in that state? I don't know. Maybe. For how long? Well, that remains to be seen. And breathing 30 to 40 times a minute is likely fairly tiring. How long has she been like this already? 24 hours? And how much longer can she keep up that rate unassisted? And she's only managing to saturate about 88% on a non-rebreather, which is concerning. But let's keep going. Her blood pressure is 94 over 40, and her heart rate is about 118. Initially, we may dismiss the blood pressure as, oh look, that systolic's not too bad. But that's where the full picture, especially in critical care, comes into play. This patient has a pulse pressure of 54, which, doing some math, gives us a mean arterial pressure of 58. Really, our target minimum for adequate end-organ perfusion is about 65 millimeters of mercury, so we're a little bit below that target. But that's just average. Maybe she's getting good enough end-organ perfusion anyways. Let's look deeper. Let's take a look at this patient's ABGs. pH of 7.06, PaCO2 of 25, PaO2 of 53, bicarb of 11. That's 4 values and 4 causes for concern. First of all, obviously that pH, 7.06, it's sitting uncomfortably low. Normal pH is 7.35 to 7.45, and depending on who you ask, the lowest minimums you want to target are 7.15 to 7.2, and below 7, arrest is increasingly likely and may warrant some immediate intervention to try and decrease the acidemia. At 7.06, we're hovering just above that line. Do we have a management strategy for starting to normalize that pH? Something to think about. Let's keep going. Maybe the metabolic panel will be more comforting. The sodium is low at 114. Chloride slightly elevated at 106. Potassium is low at 2.3. Glucose 940. BUN 26. Creatinine 2. Well, that only raises some more concerns. Immediately jumping out should be the potassium, 2.3. That's well below the critical threshold of 2.5, with normal potassium ranging from 3.5 to 5. Wait a minute. Didn't they say that they were sending an insulin drip at 12 units per hour? Is it already running? Hold the horses, we need to stop that drip. Why? Because insulin drives potassium out of the serum and moves it intracellularly along with the glucose. Potassium follows sugar. So this insulin drip will be moving a critically low potassium in the wrong direction. Why is this a big deal, especially in the context of DKA? Well, severe hypokalemia can lead to a weakening of the respiratory muscles, which can disrupt the compensatory respiratory alkalosis we have going on here. With a pH of 7.06, an increase in the CO2 by 10 can definitely put the pH into the sub-7 range. Hypokalemia also impairs end-organ sensitivity to insulin, resulting in worsening hyperglycemia. Now, how exactly did this patient get such a low potassium? Well, the primary mechanism for excretion of potassium is through urine. About 85 to 90% is reabsorbed through the proximal tubule and the loop of Henle. But, as you'll recall, polyuria is a symptom of hyperglycemia. This decreases the reabsorption of potassium through the vast excretion demands placed on the kidneys. Hey, when you have a ton of fluid you need to get rid of, your body is less picky about being selective with reabsorption of various electrolytes. So that's probably but one of the mechanisms in this case. Keep in mind that this patient has also been throwing up, at least 4 times in the ER, and who knows how much before then. This can lead to the loss of potassium through the gastrointestinal tract as well. We need to start correcting the K before we can think about running insulin. We need to start hanging some potassium. But the downside to IV potassium is that it does cause a good deal of irritation and phlebitis. So, with that respect, various facilities have set different caps on the rates of infusions for potassium. Most places probably would hesitate to do more than 10 to 20 MEQs per hour peripherally. This may be a good time to rope in the ED attending and see if he's got the stones to put in a central line. If not, they're going to need some additional IV access to make up for it. So, this patient's K is not okay. But moving on. The sodium at 114 is seemingly low, but is it really? Normal sodium is usually 135 to 145 in that range, but in the presence of hyperglycemia, your sodium measurement may be off. It's usually actually higher than that. Dr. Katz in the 1970s concluded that sodium may be off by as much as 1.6 milliequivalents for every 100 milligrams per deciliter in increase in serum glucose, which, doing the math, puts our corrected value at 126. That's only slightly hyponatremic. It should be noted that Hillier et al. In 1999 challenged the formula by Dr. Katz and suggested that a factor of 2.4 milliequivalents for sodium should be used instead. That gives us a sodium of 134, which is not very interesting. Be sure to remember to use one of these corrected sodium values when you calculate your anion gap if you choose to do so, because if you calculate it based off the original 114, you arrive at negative 3, which may lead you to question your diagnosis of DKA in the first place. But when we use the number from Hillier, you get 17 milliequivalents, which fits the clinical picture of DKA. So, let's look at the idea that she may be hypovolemic as well. She has a mean arterial pressure that's low. She's probably in compensated-ish shock. Her BUN and creatinine are both elevated, suggesting maybe her kidneys aren't getting enough perfusion. This hypovolemia idea gains some support from the CBC, which shows a rather elevated hematocrit at 63. This patient was given a liter of saline, which might explain the ever-so-slightly elevated chloride at 106. But this patient will likely need more fluid. So that's one thing we'd like to have going during transport as well. So, to recap, we've stopped the insulin drip for the time being to allow for potassium replacement first. We're running, let's say, 40 MEQs per hour of potassium and some normal saline. But there's one last thing to address. I sort of skirted around it at the very beginning of the podcast, and that's her airway and oxygenation. There are many different approaches to this problem. Some say, let her manage her own airway and ventilation. Others are in favor of intubation. I'm in the pro-intubation camp, and here's why. This patient is obtunded and vomiting. This is an airway nightmare waiting to happen. And if her respiratory status is going to fatigue and decrease, where would we rather have her tubed? Doing a calm, semi-elective intubation in the ED? Or a crash intubation in the back of an ambulance? The choice there is pretty obvious. Plus, the pulse ox and PaO2 make it pretty clear that she is not oxygenating sufficiently, even with a non-rebreather set at 15 liters per minute. We need to take control of that airway. But this is where we can potentially kill our patient. If we were to do traditional RSI with etomidate and sucks, she would have an apneic period. Even if we observed best practices, kept our time short, maintained apneic oxygenation via high-flow nasal O2, we will cause an increase in CO2 levels, which will cause a decrease in pH. This is what causes many peri-intubation arrests. So we'll need to approach this airway problem a little bit differently, probably with some ketamine-based disassociation and conscious or semi-conscious technique for intubation. Once we've secured the endotracheal tube, we're faced with another decision point. How will we set the vent? The emergency department default of rate of 12 and volume of 500 will not suffice here. She's going to need a rate fairly close to her natural drive. There's a choice to be made here. Do we set the ventilator rate low and let her trigger or overbreathe the vent? That's certainly one option. We could do SIMV with a rate of 20, and even throw on some pressure support to keep her respiratory muscles from getting too fatigued. But fatigue will still be a risk. And when she fatigues, her rate and minute volume will fall, which will put her into the same downward spiral of acidosis here that we're trying to avoid. On the flip side, if we were to put her on assist control, her tidal volume is assured. But at that rate, breath stacking becomes a monumental concern. In my opinion, I would think that going with assist control, either in volume or in PRVC mode, and taking control for airway is the way to go. And I'd like to take it one step further. When she's intubated and being ventilated appropriately, she may need the panacea to all ills. And by that I mean pancuronium. Pancuronium, as you're probably aware, is a long-acting paralytic. In this particular case, I think it'll be beneficial, given proper analgesia and sedation, of course. I don't think I want the patient triggering their own breaths or exerting any respiratory effort on their own behalf. During periods of high respiratory effort or distress, up to half the VO2, the body's oxygen demand, can be comprised of respiratory muscle use. I'd rather that the respiratory muscles not use up oxygen and generate additional CO2 that needs to be offloaded. We just have to be vigilant during our hour-long transport that our sedation and analgesia doesn't wane, leaving our patient paralyzed and in pain. Probably a good time for a fentanyl drip. So that's my take on the management of this complex patient. The most important thing to take away is to understand when you may be in over your head and when you may need help. This patient is a train wreck. It's too much for one provider to handle. And as some would point out, that's the advantage of a flight service. You're accompanied by another flight paramedic or flight nurse, which can help augment your capabilities and manage the pumps. No one should have to wrangle a herd of pumps by themselves. Don't be a lone cowboy. Do you have a different take on how you'd like to manage this patient? Tell us your approach on the CritMedic website or on our social media. There is more than one way to make an omelet. Only by sharing and sampling all the dishes at a full med potluck can we truly appreciate the different approaches. So please, don't be shy. You can follow us on social media via Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, and join in the discussion. Until next time, CritMedic listeners, keep thinking differently.